This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
This is The 11th Hour. I'm Páraic Branagh. Welcome to this week's selection from The 11th Hour podcast. Yesterday, Godot Theatre Company opened its production of Waiting for Godot at the Everyman Palace in Cork. The company is administered by John Calder, Beckett's friend and publisher. When I spoke to John, he talked to me about the importance of the play to Beckett and the success of Waiting for Godot.
Far and Away, it's probably on in 2,000 theatres around the world tonight. It absolutely took Paris by storm in 1953 when Beckett, with a totally unknown Irish writer who'd been living 25 years in Paris or in France, and it changed his life. Both his parents were dead. They were business people in Dublin who couldn't understand how they had this son who was brilliant at university but just couldn't earn a penny, you know, couldn't hold down a job and didn't particularly want to. And suddenly he became the best-known writer of his time. And without any question, I mean, he's better known than any other Irish person ever, you know, all over the world. I mean, there are over 100,000 books have been published about him in many different languages. He's better known than St. Patrick. People don't like me saying that, but it is true, I'm afraid. And at the age of 47, he suddenly became a world star. The trouble is, he's less known in Ireland than he is in most other countries. People are still a bit afraid of him, and they shouldn't be, because he's a very human, down-to-earth writer who writes about real people, their problems, their lives, and what life is all about. And everybody comes out feeling that they've had a great experience, and nobody ever forgets a Beckett play if it's properly done, and we certainly do it properly.
We're probably a bit embarrassed here in Ireland, the fact that Beckett chose to live in exile, to leave our country and to turn his back on us. We're probably a little bit embarrassed about that still. I wonder why he did that.
Well, it's happened to so many Irish writers. James Joyce had the same problem. In Ireland, people rather tend to like the tradition they have. When somebody does something new and different, usually you've got to be very old or dead before people recognise it. I mean, the Irish artists of all kinds have always tended to go abroad, and usually to Paris, because there they get recognised very much faster, and only when they're really famous abroad, then the Irish pick them up and are proud of them.
In London, the play was premiered in London 2 years after Paris. It didn't seem to go down so well initially in London.
Oh, it had terrible reviews, except one critic, Harold Hobson of the Sunday Times in London, who championed it week after week after week. The other critics went back, changed their minds, and eventually it ran for over a year. When it first was done in Paris, it saved a small little theatre from bankruptcy, ran for 10 months, then moved into a bigger theatre. Beckett was extremely lucky. If it hadn't been for the success of Waiting for Godot, and the fact that it was done in Paris and likes controversy, they would probably be unknown today, except for a very small number of artistic friends.
You met Beckett at that time, and you asked him about his publishing.
Well, that's it. I met him in 1954. I knew him until he died in 1989. We were great friends, and we were friends long before I became his publisher, because he had another publisher doing Waiting for Godot. But when they turned down his novels, I took them on, and I published his poetry, and I published some other plays, and I published roughly 85% of his work, and still do. Also, I had the advantage, because he began writing in French after the war, and I could read French, and the other publishers were not very familiar with it and had no particular background in translating books from other languages. But in the end, he wrote in both languages. If he wrote in French, he then translated into English. If he wrote in English, he then translated into French. All his work, except for the very late work, now exists in both languages.
There was some controversy about his original work, his new novels at the time.
Well, his first novel, the first book of fiction anyhow, book of short stories, was called War Pricks and Kicks, which actually is a quotation from St. Paul. But the censors didn't like it in Dublin very much, didn't like the title, and it went on the index in Ireland of books that Catholics were not allowed to read.
Of course, yeah. But there was also official censorship. I'm not sure whether War Pricks and Kicks was officially censored or not.
No, it wasn't officially censored, but it was a book that Catholics were not allowed to read. And, of course, Joyce had exactly the same problem.
But censorship also existed in the UK and in the US, and you had some joust at censorship in your publishing career.
Well, I did. I published some novels, American novel in particular, that got me into the High Court, the Old Bailey, and I was there for 2 years fighting it out, finally won on appeal.
What was the novel?
It was called Last Exit to Brooklyn. And without it, almost every European language, but the English one that was attacked. But it was the Billy Graham Crusade that decided they were going to attack somebody, and they unfortunately picked on me. I fought my corner, and I won it. And I might say that when I lost at the Old Bailey, all our lawyers said, "You're wasting your time if you appeal, because nobody's going to go against the jury decision." But I found a friend of mine, John Mortimer, who was also a playwright, to defend me, and he was brilliant, you know, and the appeal court, we won. So it was a very historic victory.
And that changed the face of British publishing after that.
Well, it did. I mean, there'd been a previous case, the Lady Chatterley case, where Penguin won. It was just unfortunate. I mean, the book that I published was pretty harmless, and the film that came out a few years later was much stronger than the novel was. But there it is. You know, times change and people get used to things.
You also had problems with publishing in America in the 50s also.
Yes, but mainly over political books during the McCarthy period. I published a lot of books at the extreme right-wing fundamentalists and the McCarthy group didn't like in Britain. Books that often couldn't be published by American authors. But then I, you know, moved more and more into literature. Without any question, Samuel Beckett was my biggest discovery.
You said recently that you're afraid that the idea of conviction publishing has gone out of fashion completely.
Well, unfortunately, publishing has become very commercial. Everybody's looking for a bestseller. They don't mind if it's good or if it's bad, as long as it sells. Publishers who would fight for years to put over somebody like Joyce or Beckett, well, I don't say they don't exist anymore, but all the odds are against them. It's very, very difficult. But I think, you know, that this tour we're doing, Waiting for Godot, because it's a wonderful production, has been acclaimed everywhere, is going to change the Irish perception of Beckett to a certain extent. We're bringing him to places that have never seen him beforehand. And we are doing missionary work. We're bringing a great playwright to audiences that are really loving him.
The thing about the Godot is that it's very clearly defined in the script what exactly you're supposed to do with it. Beckett didn't like people changing his stage directions. Are you being totally and absolutely faithful to the script?
Absolutely faithful. I mean, when you do it the way he wanted it done, it works. Audiences understand it. They have no difficulty with it. And they go away realizing they've had a great experience. It's when, you know, clever young directors decide they're going to put a new kind of spin on it that people get puzzled and don't understand it. Beckett knew exactly what he was doing. He had a perfect sense of the stage. His own productions, which he did mainly in Germany, became very famous and toured the world. And, you know, his spirit is with us the whole time. I mean, I knew him well enough to know exactly how he would want things done. But it's all there in the text itself. If you run away from the text, it goes wrong.
But Godot the play, it's a very bleak, unrelenting, miserable story. Or is there hope there somewhere?
Well, it's about hope. It's about hope. The main message that comes out is that however bad things are, whatever problems you're going through, there's always somebody worse off than yourself. You can always give a helping hand to somebody else. If you do, you'll feel better yourself. You'll be a better person. There's always room for hope. And it's absolutely full of humour. I mean, the audience, they have a great deal to laugh at, and they do laugh.
It is true, though, but Godot is quite humorous. They're clowns, aren't they, the two main characters?
Well, they are. I mean, you know, Beckett used to see the Chaplin films and Laurel and Hardy and that kind of thing. And to a certain extent, it's based on it. But it's also based on his wartime experiences. When he was hiding from the Germans in a little village, he and a Jewish painter, they'd have to go off and hide in the woods every time the Germans came through. And when you're hiding in the woods, sometimes for days on end, well, you've got to pass the time with word games and, you know, any way you can pass the time. And that's the background situation. Now, Beckett managed to universalize the play into all of human life. Everybody finds something about themselves in it. And often people have secret thoughts they don't like sharing with other people. Suddenly, he makes audiences realize those thoughts are not so secret. Other people have them too. And they can start to be more honest with themselves. What Beckett does, basically, is give people the courage to face reality. I mean, the horrible things are happening around us all the time. You just have to listen to the news or read the newspapers to know it. But people tend to, you know, not think about it, not want to put unpleasantness away. Well, you can't get away from unpleasantness in life. It's there. You've got to face it. And if you face it, and develop the courage to face it, then ultimately your life's going to be a little bit better.
I actually never heard that that was the basis of Godot, that he was hiding away. I knew he was involved in the French Resistance.
Well, he joined a group in Paris that was sending information to Britain and, above all, trying to get airmen who'd been shot down out of the country through Spain. So he was a courier with the resistance group. Now, most of them were caught and killed. He was very lucky. He managed to escape. And he spent 4 years hiding in this little village. And he also took part in sort of Mackie, you know, resistance movements down there as well, blowing up bridges and that kind of thing. He told me he never actually shot anybody, which he was rather pleased about. But he certainly did things. And he was rewarded by de Gaulle after the war with the Croix de Guerre, you know, decoration. He was always very modest about that, never talked about it.
It's extraordinary, really, because that was quite a brave thing to do, to resist the fascists.
Well, he was. I mean, he was in Dublin, the war broke out, but he decided he would rather be with his friends, artistic friends in Paris at war than in Dublin at peace. And Dublin, anyhow, had always treated him rather badly. He didn't, I mean, he was at home there, away, you know, with his family and friends and all that. But the atmosphere didn't suit him very much. And Dublin rejected him as a writer. He just couldn't take him.
Did he say that to you? Did he, when you have lunch in the Montparnasse, did he say to you, Dublin rejected me as a writer? What was his, how did he describe Ireland? Had he got over this at this stage?
Well, he was always very fond of Ireland. He was always very aware that he was Irish, you know, and wonderful memories, and he loved the landscape and loved Ireland as such. But he didn't love the literary scene very much. It was, you know, very narrow, very parochial, and very opposed to any kind of new ideas at all. And he was much happier abroad. But, I mean, Irish artists of all kinds have always had to flee the country a little bit. Sometimes, like Louis Le Brocq, was also a friend of his, to go back again eventually.
Tell me something. As a personal friend of Beckett, what was he like?
He was a very simple man, very erudite, but he never flaunted the erudition. Incredibly well read. He was just a very good friend, I mean, a straightforward, simple person. I mean, he would meet, you know, ordinary people in the street, be friendly with them, and they often didn't know that he was a writer at all, let alone a famous writer. He was a simple, straightforward, ordinary sort of person, but with a genius inside him. Without any question, he was a genius. But he was also a very charitable person. I mean, he lived personally rather like a monk, you know. Even when he was earning money, he didn't spend it on himself, he gave it away to other people. He was an almost saint-like character.
And why do we have this impression of him as being a recluse, being hostile, of not wanting to engage?
Oh, that's because journalists would go to interview him, and they try to make a good story, and they would distort everything. So he just got fed up with all that. So he wouldn't see journalists, except one or two who were friends and didn't write about him.
And that was John Calder there, the administrator of the Godot Company, whose production of Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot opened at the Cork's Everyman Palace Theatre yesterday. I'm now joined by Eivor Walsh, a lecturer in Anglo-Irish Literature at UCC, to talk a little more about the production of Beckett, and later on we'll be talking about the Meridian production of Exit Wound at the Triskell Arts Centre in Cork. Eivor, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Porrick.
Godot, remind us of the story, or the non-story, of Waiting for Godot.
Nothing happens twice, isn't it?
That's it, yeah.
Two men waiting by a tree for Godot, Mr. Godot, who sends a messenger, a boy, who says, he can't come today, please wait until tomorrow. And then two other men arrive in, Pozzo, who's driving, he's sort of servant Lucky, and they have a little interchange, and then they move off. Then night falls, and then we get the same thing again.
John Calder there spoke of the influence of this play had on modern theatre. Well, what exactly did it do to modern theatre?
I was thinking about that as I was watching it tonight. It must have been such a shock to see a play of this style. It's so pared down, and that's what I liked about tonight's production. The set was so simple, the acting, which I thought was very good tonight, but it must have been revolutionary in 53, moving so far away from sort of the conventions of theatre, and really a very, I suppose, philosophical or existential, very elemental play.
But it was kind of a nihilistic. Theatre was always rich with big, rich draperies and red satin curtains and all those sort of effects to get carry on the conceit. But this was nihilistic.
I suppose it was. It may be part of that way in which the great dramas also were being remade at the time, I suppose, like the Royal Shakespeare, taking Shakespeare and taking away all the trappings and sort of stripping it down to its essential. I suppose it caught the mood. One of the things that struck me tonight, again, I've seen it a few times, but it always, every time I see it, I forget how religious it is. I mean, how concerned it is with questions of belief or of the absence of belief, and how much the Bible is in the play.
John Calder mentioned there that the actual circumstance in which Godot envisaged Godot was when he was hiding out from the Gestapo during the war.
Imagine that. These two men are sort of surviving, Didi and Gogo are just surviving in the countryside, slightly afraid. They get beaten up. They're living on turnips, carrots and the odd radish. And you can imagine the sort of endless boredom of waiting or to be captured or not be captured. Because there's threat always at the fringes of the Godot universe.
I always thought, though, that Godot, that, you know, and it never occurred to me until John mentioned it to me the last day we were talking, and I said, I never seen a Godot with enough terror in it that would describe how you feel when the Gestapo is hunting the woods for you.
I suppose this, when Gogo heads off and he's been beaten up during the night, he comes back with more wounds, and also they're physically sort of deteriorating, and all of the attitude and the violence between Lucky and Pozzo. I suppose that maybe is where the elements creep in.
I'm looking forward next time I see it, actually, just to examine it from that perspective. But to go back to your new revelation, it's been religious. The Bible is important. Well, Godot, that was always maintained, God was Godot, isn't that what they maintain?
Maybe. And also you have Estragon and Vladimir, who are also known as Gogo and Didi, and I suppose put them together, you seem to get God waiting out there. And they do refer to God a lot, and there is, you know, they draw on biblical stories. So it struck me that, I don't know if you wrote that play now, whether it would have those kinds of testings and questions, you know.
That at the time in the 50s, people were questioning the nature of God after the big carnage of the war and that the breaking down of the established church, that God, that you could actually discuss God.
That's maybe the only way in which the play shows its own particular period. Otherwise, it's very universal and it works in that particular way.
But why is it universal? What is it about God that transcends the years and the movements in theatre?
I suppose he strips it down to such an essential questioning. There's nothing between them and that universe. They're looking at this tree, they're looking at the moon, they're waiting for this eternal day, eternal night. There isn't much in between, really. And I suppose that's must have been the revolution that Beckett created. An absolutely essential rendering of, you know, existence, you know, mankind in this adrift in this enormous hostile universe, and actually putting it on the stage for once.
So it's the essential man.
It seems to be, and that's what I liked about the production tonight. Physically it was very simple, but actually it also moved. I've seen it a few times, and what I liked about tonight's is it moved very quickly.
You know, that's interesting, because I was talking to John and I was saying to him like that. Well, you know, Beckett wrote very strict stage directions, nearly as bad as Brian Freed, by all accounts.
Yes.
That he wrote very strict stage, when bad is the wrong word there. But he wrote a lot of stage directions, and he wanted the play to be exactly the same every time. And you've seen lots of Godots. Had they been all exactly the same?
No, and I mean, could he control the pacing of it? I mean, maybe that's what it seemed to me, that there was a kind of sharpness and a speed. I also really liked the voices. I particularly liked Dan Milan, who was playing Gogo tonight, the clarity of the voice. And then the Pozzo, who's played by Peter Pacey, he had a huge range of voice. He went up, he went down, you know what I mean? He did all sorts of voices, but you could hear every syllable of both of them. So they managed, well, all of them indeed, they managed to move it quickly, but they also managed to move it very distinctly. So I suppose one of the things you can play with is how quickly or how slowly you can go. And I have to say, I've seen slower Godots and I didn't enjoy them as much.
I'm inclined to agree with you. I think people, I've certainly seen some Irish Godots here. One of them in North Dublin City, which was slow as a long, wet week. Mm-hmm. There seems to be a tendency in Ireland to make it as slow as possible.
I wouldn't agree with that. I mean, the play is bleak enough, and then you get the humour that comes out of that, and what it's dealing with is quite sharp. I mean, I just preferred the kind of humour and the quality. And also, they use their accents very well. We had a Cork and a Dublin, and a kind of almost an Anglo-Irish accent being used throughout, and then the young boy who was playing the boy, Ethan Lawler, using his own voice. So I liked that a lot. It sort of moved around a little bit in terms of accents.
Well, that's good, because not often the accents in Godot can be very bland. Mm-hmm. But the humour is like graveyard humour, isn't it? The people say Godot's very funny, but it is very dark humour, isn't it?
It is, but I enjoyed that. And I mean, they had good fun with the hats, where they moved them all around, and the faces were very good. I mean, particularly Angus McNamara. Towards the end, he had a very good comic face, but by gosh, when there was a kind of tragedy looming, and his face was very, very affecting. And then Garvin McGrath, who was playing Lucky, and of course, he doesn't talk for so long, his eyes were just full of pathos and full of wound and pain. He was brilliant. He was doing great work with his eyes.
Great. So you really enjoyed the production?
I did, actually. I thought it was very good.
We've got a couple of minutes. Let's just go across town to the Triskell Arts Centre. The Exit Wound, Meridian's new show, written and directed by Johnny Hanrahan. What's this play about?
Now, I went to see that last Wednesday. The Exit Wound uses the idea of the day that JFK was shot, but particularly how it intersected in three sort of scenes. The first being between what turns out to be a grandfather and a granddaughter. So how their life story and their family story connects with the JFK moment. And then the next section we hear a voice, the character of Pascal, and how he saw John F. Kennedy in Cork City, and then hearing of his assassination. And then finally the character of Joan, the third act, again, she and her sister, in fact her sister, I think, meeting John F. Kennedy when he comes to Cork. So it's very much the starting point is the intersection with Kennedy's, both his
Kennedy's
visit to Ireland,
like,
and then his death, exactly.
And where does the play go after that? Is there a collective sense of loss or sense of tragedy? Or what does the play do after that?
Well, they're kind of individual. So in the first scene, the audience were around a big, huge table with a cake in the centre. Sadly, we didn't get to eat the cake, but it looked, and there's a lot of discussion about the cake. But we basically sat at like an enormous dinner table, and at one end was the grandfather, played by Michael Loughnan, who I really liked. I thought he was very good. And then a young actor, Julie Kelleher, playing the granddaughter, Julia. And they talk about America, and the grandfather has lived in America all his life. And then we discover why he went to America. So it's sort of, the story unravels, and there's a connection with JFK. That's the first one. And that happens downstairs in the Triskell.
So it moves around, and it's based, as I said, on the JFK. What's your verdict on it? Was it a good night's theatre?
Oh, very much. We moved around, which I hate. I like to be able to sit down and get comfortable and, be lazy for the night.
But it worked as an idea?
Completely. And then we moved upstairs and heard the second piece. Then we moved to the top of the Triskell, and we saw the third section.
So theatre and a geographical adventure, but successful nonetheless.
Oh, very much so.
Thank you very much, Eva, for being with us. The All-Ireland One Act Drama Festival finals are taking place this weekend in Carrickmore, County Tyrone. 11 drama groups from around the country are competing in the festival, which is hosted by the Amateur Drama Council of Ireland and the Drama League of Ireland. To preview the event and talk about one-act drama, I'm joined in the Dundalk studio by writer and broadcaster Breeze McBride. Playwright Tara Lovett and actor Dara Caron are here in Dublin with me. You're all very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Boris.
Dara, how does a group enter this competition, and how long does it take to get to the final?
There's a series of preliminary festivals that take part around the country for about 5 weeks, starting at the end of October and through November. And the preliminary festivals invite or offer to groups to participate, so they basically just apply to them. And then the directors of the festival would programme the plays.
And would you have two or three plays on a night?
You'd have three every night over the course of a weekend. And it takes place in various kind of halls, small theatres and community centres around the country.
And what sort of plays are presented? New plays or old plays?
There's a great mixture. There's a lot of new writing. There's very kind of traditional ones like Sean O'Casey's Bedtime Story. There's always something from Geraldine Aaron and Brian Friel.
What's Galway Girl and Brian Friel, Lovers.
Lovers, yeah, Winners or Losers. And then you'd have some of Harold Pinter's plays as well, sometimes Arthur Miller's short plays.
Did they write one-acts, did they?
They would have, yeah, very much so. There's a whole broad range of kind of high-profile playwrights who have started to present or write short plays.
Tara, you write short plays.
I did, and
why don't you write long ones?
Well, I started writing long ones. Funnily enough, I started writing long ones and found difficulty getting them produced. And so then I decided to write some short plays and take the bull by the horns myself and produce myself. So that's how I got into theatre first, was by writing and producing 2 one-act plays of my own. Now, I'm no director and no producer, but it was fun. We rehearsed in the bedroom, and you can do that one-act plays, you know, just 2 characters, and it was a good way to get me into theatre and get my work out there, you know.
And what are the restrictions or the sort of the confines of writing a one-act play?
None. There's no confines.
Except for length, of course.
Except for length, yeah, that's the only thing. I mean, you know, somewhere roughly between kind of 40 and 50 minutes. You wouldn't want to go much longer than that. But there's, from my point of view as a writer, there's no restrictions. It's very free.
And do you have a sort of like, do you have to get a much more simpler plot when you're doing a one actor? Can you have a complex plot or?
No, well, I mean, I suppose with any of the, either the short or long plays, but especially with the short plays, I tend to just focus on an image. So, say, for example, I'll see something that catches my eye, like somebody with a blue telephone in their living room. And then you just say, God, a blue telephone, that'd look great on stage. Why would they have a blue telephone? Who'd be ringing them on it? Why? And who'd be answering the phone? And those kind of things. And the play comes from that. So you just, a good, strong visual image for me for a one-act play starts the ball rolling. And then 1 or 2 characters to feed into that, answer a few questions, and that's the play.
And do the characters grow themselves as you're writing?
Absolutely. If you just, once you find the image that turns you on, the image will speak to you and then the characters will come through that. Because every image has characters. There's a story around everything that you look at, you know.
Most of these one-act plays would have a limited amount of characters. Would you have it down to 4 or 5 or less?
Well, I would usually, when I write one-acts, I usually tend to keep it to 2. But I think that's because I'm not that great at writing with 3 and 4 characters all speaking at once, you know. It's too confusing. So I just tend to keep it very simple. And it also means that the emotional intensity goes up. When we have only 2 people, there's far more emotion, there's more movement between them, and it's just a more concentrated, intense way of going about it, you know. I think more characters tend to dilute, because we can only tell the story of one image and one character, really, in a play.
In a one act, you have to limit the characters, what you're saying.
I think so.
Would you agree with that, please, McBride?
I like plays with more than 2 or 3 characters, but I have to tell you, Tara makes it sound very easy writing plays. And I came across her play, The Watchdog, in 2001 at a festival in Trim, and it absolutely blew me away because it was such an off the wall idea for a play. And I mean, it won that festival, and straight away I invited her to appear at the Dundalk Maytime Festival the following year. She writes very good short plays, but I think probably what she said was right. When you get more experience, you could probably put more characters in. But the interesting thing about the festival circuit this year, I adjudicated the festival in Balbriggan, and most of the plays I saw only had 2 characters or 3 characters. One had about 6 characters, and that was Geography of a Horse Dreamer by Sam Shepherd, and it was Braddon Players from Leixlip. But there was a Woody Allen there to Riverside Drive, and that was extremely funny. And in fact, you know, Woody Allen always writes for television, and he always writes a character for himself, but it was very interesting to see this three-hander done on the stage. And whenever it was premiered in New York, he wouldn't allow the critics into it except the bought tickets. I think it was $70 each or something. He was terrified because he didn't know whether he could direct for stage or not. But I think I can understand why the groups pick plays maybe with 2 or 3 characters, because if you have a large group and you pick a play with 2 or 3 characters, the chances are you'll get the exact right people for the parts. And all the groups want to win. So if they want to win, they're not going to cast.
That's the point, Dara. This is a competition, isn't it?
It's definitely a competition.
It's definitely a competition. Yes. Absolutely, yeah.
And then we've got the sort of the couldn't trust of a sort of a rugby match competition. Do they talk to each other before they go on, or this sort of stuff?
Well, that's actually the beauty of these one-act festivals, is that they get to talk to each other. So on every given night of the festival, you'll have at least 3 groups there, and they'll hang around and they'll talk and they'll discuss what they
and
like Dara, and
they
enjoy.
Also see each other's plays.
And they get to see each other and see what yes. level the others are at. But interestingly enough, this year at the festivals that I was at, there were a lot more plays, and particularly in the new writing, that had larger casts. So in Kilmuckridge, where I was a couple of weekends ago, out of the 9 plays that I saw, 6 of them had large casts.
Oh, right.
So it's kind of cyclical. It goes through periods where you have these monologue-type plays, and then suddenly people want more characters. But I think Tara's right. To engage an audience for a short period of time like that, they really want to relate to and know and understand the characters as well.
Yeah, but I also think there's another reason why they're a short cast, because some of the groups use the one-act circuit to try out new directors, to give new directors some experience, and it's easier for a new director to direct a play.
That's right, because I heard people talking about...
And to block a play with a small number of casts.
Yeah, and they talk about it as being an apprenticeship for both actors, directors and the technical
crew. Yeah, I think it is, yeah, but not so much for the actors, because I saw very few inexperienced actors in Balbriggan this year.
But is that not putting down the art form of the one-act play by saying it's a trial piece or an apprentice piece, is it not, Tara?
Well, for me it's not an apprentice piece. I mean, it can be just as compelling as a full-length play. And I suppose the other thing about it is you have to think about, not that I agree with it, but where theatre is going at the moment is we're in a computer age. People don't want to sit in a theatre for 2.5 hours or 2 hours.
No, you're right, Tara.
A shorter play is, it's sexier now to write a shorter piece, to have no interval and just have a one act, go in, come out, go and get a burger, go home in the dark.
But
even a
full length, even Eugene O'Brien's full length play, there's no interval in that and it only lasts 90 minutes. And it's a full-length play, so I think Tara's right. There's definitely, the plays are definitely getting shorter.
Well,
and
I noticed that with Doubt now in the Abbey there recently. That's the biggest grossing play in Broadway ever, and it was only an hour and 10 minutes long.
That's right.
So soon we're going to have 3-second plays, like Goldfish plays.
What, like Samuel Beckett's plays?
Well, I don't know.
So they say that's been done before.
But tell us, anyways, I want to ask the adjudicator and the victim, the playwright here, about your relationship. Tell us, adjudicator first. Tell us, how do you mark the plays? How do you evaluate these people's
Which
work?
Which adjudicator are you talking
you
to?
You were the adjudicator here, didn't you? You were the one that self-proclaimed adjudicator here.
Yeah. There's a marking system. The DLI and ADCI have set down a marking system. So there are 40 marks for acting, 35 for production, 15 for presentation, and 10 for dramatic achievement. And it's actually very easy to adjudicate.
What would you call dramatic achievement? Go on, Dara.
How you interpret the play and present it.
If you read the play, you know, when I read a play, I have a vision of what the writer means when the writer writes that play. And I like to see it achieved to the full. I hate to see, maybe if it's a comedy and they lose some of the laughs in it, or if it's a serious play and they don't get the high dramatic moments in it.
It's to have due regard for the author's intent, but the festival themselves and the adjudicators, their remit isn't to actually assess the play or the writing in the play. It's about how the play is interpreted and interpreted and presented to the audiences.
Yeah.
And the dramatic achievement is the bit that says, have you achieved or have you had due regard for the author's intent? Have you brought it out to the audience and have you made it live from the page? So that's what that element is about.
You lifted it from the page,
So basically, Tara, if the adjudicator gives you a nil point, you blame the cast.
The funny thing is, from my point of view, from a writer's point of view, I'm there to serve the actors. So my buzz comes from, if the people doing the play are having fun and telling me they're having a great time, job done. That's my job. That's what I'm there to do. And then however it translates to the audience is their job. So I'm not worried at all, really, about the adjudication or a marking system.
It's you don't just mind if you get no points?
I don't mind if I get no points if the director and the actors are coming back saying we're having a ball.
The most interesting thing about it is, from the audience point of view, it creates great debate because they see three different styles at a short play festival on any given night. So instead of being kind of looking at one style that they mightn't agree with or they mightn't fully enjoy, they get an opportunity to see different various kind of
And when you come up with the situation, Bridge, where you have the same play done by two different companies in the same weekend, would you ever come up with that situation? You avoid that, would you?
I haven't, but I did come up against that a few times when I was judging. I do a lot of judging for the US Army in Europe, and very often they would have the same play. And it's very, very interesting how a different group of people can take a different dynamic to the same play. I just find that seriously interesting.
Yeah, but it's happened before at the All-Irelands where you would have two companies doing the same play.
There's a
Sheila Stevenson play called Five Kinds of Silence.
Yes.
And two groups from different parts of the country, or from Dublin actually, did them.
Yeah.
And they were both very strong, both very good, but very, very different interpretations.
Yeah.
And the audience appreciated both of them equally.
Yeah,
it was extraordinary night that night.
Well, did one of them win the actual award that night? Or
Estrie won the festival that year, the All-Ireland,
with that play.
That play, yeah.
God, anyway, that must have been tough on the other group.
The other group did very well.
the festival that I did this year in Balbriggan, the first, second and third in the open section are all through to the All-Ireland. And I have to say, I haven't seen the other plays that are through in the open section, but any of those three plays would be very worthy All-Ireland winners. That's Blue Transit with Riverside Drive and Kilcock Music and Drama Society with A Kind of Vesuvius, that's Gillian Plowman, and Bradon with Geography of a Horse Dreamer, this crazy, daft Sam Shepherd play.
But tell us something, would not it be better, I think competition stifles creativity, would not it be better if you had a big cast and get everybody involved in the process rather than just narrowing it down to two-handers and everybody wants to win the medal or get the All-Ireland?
Yeah.
Actually, but the drama is not the priority, it's winning is the priority. Is that the case, Tara?
But as part of the whole year, this is only a small section of the year, throughout the whole year there are groups all over the country, schools, universities, ICAs, MOCRAs, community centres, groups all presenting one-act plays or short plays throughout the year. So in the great kind of scheme of things for the whole year, it is an important part because people want to be recognised for their achievements, just the way you have people in the professional sector like to be recognised and get their awards. But outside of that, the whole year is made up of many, many groups across the country presenting short plays.
But I think the whole bottom line of why this one-act competition is so important, it is to get play scripts out of drawers. You know, people shove them into drawers or leave them on the computer and don't print them off or whatever. And it's definitely a reason for groups to look for new plays, particularly new Irish plays. I mean, what other platform have you really for short plays? You have the Lunchtime at Bewley's, but really you don't have it. Like, the professional theatres don't generally do short plays.
Well, we look forward to the weekend and the festival. Thank you very much for being with us, Breeze McBride, Tara Lovett and Derek Carlin.
Thanks.
And the All-Ireland One Act Drama Festival finals are taking place this weekend, 1st, 2nd, 3rd of December in Carrickmore in County Tyrone. For more information, go to www.adci.ie. I hope you enjoyed this week's edition of the 11th Hour podcast. The 11th Hour is live on RTÉ Radio 1, Mondays to Fridays, at 11 p.m. From me, Páraic Branagh, and the rest of the team in the 11th Hour, Slán.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTÉ Radio 1. For more details of our podcasts, visit rte.ie/radio1.